I'm Sophie Natto, and you're listening to the second season of The Middle. If you're a media geek and work in public relations, journalism, or marketing, you're in the right place.
Why is our email, why are our texts, why are our snaps, why is everything filled with such garbage?
There's just so much out there right now, I don't even think most people realize how much their brain has to handle.
Today, we're talking about our brains on social media. We need it, we love it, we hate it. Everyone is there, but we don't actually trust it. And yet, our work to reach audiences happens there because that's where most people consume content. So, how do we navigate this? Catherine Jansen is the National Communications Director for the Canadian Mental Health Association. Formerly the Director of Communications for Participation here in Toronto, she began her career as a journalist for CTV News. El-Amin Abdel-Mahmoud is a news curation and social media editor for BuzzFeed News. He also writes columns for several other Canadian publications, and this fall, he's co-hosting a new podcast about Canadian politics for the CDC with Rosie Barton. So welcome to you both to the first podcast of the second season. I'm so happy to have you guys here with an important issue ahead of us in the next 30 minutes or so. Our research here at Edelman tells us that social media is the least trusted form of distribution here in this country. So why is it that so many Canadians find themselves down that rabbit hole on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram on a day-to-day basis? What do you think, Catherine?
I think it's convenience. I think that's part of a broader trend in our society that everything is becoming more convenient, you know, whether it be Uber Eats. It's the Uber Eats of news, I guess. Basically, it just delivers the information that you want, the validation that you want, the answers that you want, wherever you are in the course of your day. And there's also this real sort of blur between social media for work and social media for personal use. So it's sort of this gray zone where I think that it's socially acceptable to sort of get your fix and stay in tune with what's going on.
Yeah, it drives me crazy though. I mean, friends will be on their phone, on social media, right in front of me where they could have a real conversation, El-Amin.
I don't think I'm guilty of this. I do not accept
you're actually quite good. It's true.
But I will say, like, there's something about social media that gives the feeling that everyone else is hanging out without you. So in terms of just being plugged into the constant stream, I'm especially guilty of this on Twitter. So the thought is, like, not just like what just happened in the news, but like what is everyone saying and what do I have to say about it? So it's this constant feeling of like, if we speak, then someone is listening. And then it kind of inflates, I think, a little bit the worth of what you have to offer to the world. Like, imagine if a big breaking news story happened and you didn't chime in with what you have to say. Will the world end? Mm-hmm. No, but it kind of feels like it. And so I think a lot of people end up participating in this stream in that way, just like wanting to constantly sort of chime in with their thoughts on the news and then comment on other people's reflections. And then you kind of end up being hooked in.
It's especially the case in our industry, right, Catherine? I mean, I'm sure you must get questions about this all the time, but in early June, I decided I would take a break from social and I was off. Yeah. So a lot of people said, wait a second, you work in PR. How can you stop? And I did from June 24th until very recently. And it was weird. I felt like, to El-Amin's point, like maybe I just ceased to exist for a little bit of time. Why is that?
Well, I guess, I mean, it's FOMO, right? But it sounds to me like what El-Amin was saying is it's not necessarily that there's something wonderful that you're getting every time you're on social. It's more like you're afraid of what you're not getting if you're not on it.
Yeah.
So that's the true fear of missing out, I guess, right?
Well, and the other thing too, so I've had arguments with other folks who are in our industry about whether social media helps or creates loneliness. And I know this is an emerging topic. Like, we need connection with each other to live and to survive and to thrive. And one of the things that I thought was really scary about coming off social was this idea was like, would I have anybody left? Like, who would be around to hang out with me?
What did you find?
I found, well, that my list of people I love and care about is much, 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 much smaller than I thought, but much mightier than I thought.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's okay. I mean, if you look at some of the research or just the discussion out there in the mental health world about loneliness and isolation and connection, loneliness sometimes gets confused with being lonely, that somehow, you know, more people is more connection, fewer people is more lonely. But it's not really about the volume of people in your life. It's about the depth of the connection. So there's this whole idea of your five, that if you have five people, who are those people that you could cultivate as being the people that you would, you know, you could go to for anything, that you, they would drop everything for you, that you could do the same for them, kind of thing. And if you have, you know, sort of, let's say, five strong relationships around you, family, friends, whoever, mm-hmm. I mean, you're good. You don't need 500,000 people around you to feel
so this is like, less lonely. So Catherine, so Elamine had, like, Elamine, you have a huge following. How do you stay focused on those deep connections? Can you stay focused? Because, you know, again, in our industry, like, most of the people we know to do this work, you have to stay connected at that velocity. But what impact does it have on you personally?
I think to a certain extent, I'm relatively aware. I say relatively because hopefully I'm very aware, but I think I'm relatively aware at the very least that anything I do on social media is to a certain extent a performance. Like, I get something in front of an audience, and that audience, like, has a relationship with that person on that stage. But it's not necessarily, like, you know, a relationship with me. Like, that's not, you know, that's kind of reserved for the people who have an actual proximity to my life.
But people mix that up all the time, I'm sure, with you, right? They'll be like, well, we're friends, woohoo, right?
I mean, they do that with The Rock. You know what I mean? Like, they do that with everyone. Like, to a certain extent, the existing on social media gives you the impression that that all these people are participating in your life by liking or commenting. But that is a very superficial kind of participation in our lives. And the sooner you figure out, like, the kinds of participations you value and the kinds you don't, I think the healthier relationship you'll have with social media, so that you don't end up basing your self-esteem and then your mental health and then your evaluation of whether you're alone or lonely or not based on whether people are liking or commenting, you know, on your post.
Yeah, but Catherine, we've seen a lot of examples of people who, I mean, Elamine's, that's an evolved perspective, performatory, like, anger and people just, you know, making this their everyday life. I mean, how healthy are people in general on these channels? What does the research tell us?
Well, I think there's a lot of, I mean, there's no one answer, and I think that's always a little bit frustrating. But I think that, you know, there's extreme examples, and then there's sort of the day-to-day behaviors. So things like bullying that can happen online, where people are either being targeted or stalked or, you know, attacked, DM'd with, you know, explicit photos. There is ugly behavior happening that's just not necessarily caused by social media, but is facilitated or, you know, happens on social media. Mm-hmm. And that is the same kind of detrimental effects that you would feel if someone was peeking in your real window at home or following you home from work or whatever. Yeah. That's, you know, there's negative behaviors that can happen on social.
That's insidious, though. Like, what about the not so obvious, like, groupthink and echo chambers? And we've seen, like, you know, Twitter mobs rise occasionally for good and for bad.
I think that's fair. I guess one way to look at it is, let's say social media is like food, right? So food inherently is not good or bad. But if you look at, you know, different diets, can be either a healthy diet or can be an unhealthy diet. Mm. And it's about what you choose to consume out of this wide array of options, kind of thing. So, right. And it does require being a little bit more intentional. I think part of where people do get into trouble is this, either if they're going on for the wrong reasons, so that they're, you know, they're insecure and expecting their securities to be somehow, you know, they're tying their self-worth to the amount of likes they get.
How common is that?
Well, I think research shows that in younger kids, you know, it is common, especially on the platforms like, you know, Instagram, which are more visual, especially in young women, where a young person's identity, the way society sort of socialized people to think of their physical appearance as being part of their inherent self-worth. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden you're putting out your self-image, your you know, pictures of your body or your face on social media, especially where they can be retouched and altered and perfected. Right. And then you're expecting people to either respond positively or negatively. You can see how slippery that slope is. Like, if I get more likes, I'm better looking and I feel better. And then conversely, the opposite is true. So that's really dangerous.
I was really surprised, Elamine, while I was on my social media break, my daughter came home from a play date. She's 7 and wanted to look at TikTok, which I had never opened. And we went down that rabbit hole. And I was just shocked, like, the speed of content, the way, how fast it goes, one, and how sexualized it is in a lot of ways, two. is this the inevitable sort of outcome of our consumption, do you think? Because, I mean, TikTok is like next gen speed in terms of putting stuff into our brains. What's your take on that?
I mean, I think there's something about particularly the speed that TikTok operates on, that, you know, there's no social media platform on the planet, no matter how socially conscious it is, that's going to go out of its way to make sure you spend less time on that platform. Mm. That's just not in their interest. You know, like it's very nice of Instagram to say we're going to do a lot of things to make the user experience better. None of that includes spending less time on Instagram, because that means less time looking at the ads on Instagram. So when it comes to TikTok, you know, its speed is a function of that, right? It's like a video goes by so quickly, 10 to 15 seconds, and then you either rewatch that video or you just serve up a whole new one so you can go down a new rabbit hole.
Yeah.
The reason it's so popular, and it became like an offspring of Musical.ly, which is a different...
Oh, interesting.
It's a former platform that used to be just like you can lip sync to a bunch of different videos.
It feels like Vine, but like on speed.
Yeah, that's what it feels like. Slightly longer Vine, and then like, everything just moves much faster.
Yeah.
And that is what's effective. I think it's effective because your attention is grabbed at all times. And I think, like, to me, that's their entire currency. Their currency is attention, and they're able to sort of hold on to it as much as possible.
I mean, Catherine, it's like we can't stand being by ourselves or being bored anymore. Like, that's kind of the feeling I had, and I had to put the phone down. I'm like, okay, this needs to stop
Well, that's absolutely, because it's not just about the messaging or the pictures that people see. It's about the physical time that people spend. So there was another study recently that showed that some of the effects on mental health in young people in England, it's not just about the experience they're having once they're online. It's about what it's displacing from their lives. You know, is it impacting the amount of sleep they're getting or the amount of physical activity they're getting? They're spending, you know, an extra hour or 2 hours or 6 hours on screens. That's got to be at the expense of something.
Right.
Right. Okay.
That's
so
scary.
It is. I mean, this program is about PR, marketing, and journalism. So the three of us need these distribution channels to do our job. So what obligation do journalists or companies have as they use these channels to propel their messages and campaigns? I mean, Catherine, at the CMHA, do you guys have like protocol on how you operate on these channels or any kind of best guidance, best practice?
Yeah, I mean, for us, because at the Canadian Mental Health Association, one of our aims is to educate and advocate for... both people who have experienced mental illness in their families, but also for the average Canadian. And this is an interesting way to look at it too, is just that when we talk about mental health, people often think, oh, mental health, they actually think you use that as a euphemism for mental illness. So they're thinking of people who have a problem, an illness or a disorder, but it's actually not just about the 1 in 5 Canadians who have a mental illness or challenge in a given year. It's about the 5 in 5 Canadians who have mental health. So you can impact your mental health, i.e. reduce the quality of your day or how you feel about yourself or make you more stressed or less happy. It might not be at the point of depression or anxiety or disorder,
right,
but it's still not doing a good thing for your life. Right. So for us at CMHA, it's really the channel is not just about, you know, promoting what we've got in terms of programs and services. It's actually effectively a service unto itself, because there are people who interact with us who either learn about our policy messages, who are being educated about what mental health is and isn't, and who are finding a community unto itself. So,
like, and great conversations on Instagram specifically. You've had a lot of success there, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so the challenge is not necessarily even about the policies, about what we're posting. It's about how you respond to how people respond.
Because, tricky.
You know, especially you can end up, if you want to be bold and provocative and push the needle and advance the issue, sometimes you're going to rub people the wrong way. And then what do you do? And I think that's a really important point. And one policy we do have is if we're having an uncomfortable conversation, we don't take it to DMs. We don't.
Oh, interesting.
We try and let that play out in the public domain so that people can see.
Right.
So an example, for instance, is recently there was a study about that showed that mental health, that people's happiness levels were more impacted by the amount of exercise they got than about their economic status.
Interesting.
And so the headline was, you know, exercise makes you happier than money. And a lot of people were saying, yay, good, love that, whatever.
Elamine's like, and maybe not.
Some,
but okay.
Some people, because we really do advocate for, you know, the marginalized, for the vulnerable, and good mental health is tied into economic status and housing and secure housing and all these things.
Yep.
And so we have to think about all aspects of society. And so some people had said, oh, great, so what, you just want poor people to run and, you know, they'll be happy, which is a gross oversimplification of what the study's about. And rather than sort of saying, hey, you, in a DM, but actually responding to that, no, it's nuanced, and this is why, and this is how it's complicated, in front of everybody, so that everybody can see what the response is.
That's so bold, though, Elamine, right? And I work with a lot of companies who would never put themselves out there like that. They see that as an existential risk, often to brand goals and that kind of thing. I mean, you're Elamine.
You work with a lot of companies who are very, like, controversy averse. And I get that.
Risk averse, yes, for sure. Yeah. I mean, how do you, do you have guardrails for when you work on social? Because, I mean, you're the you're the social media editor, right, for BuzzFeed? Yeah. So.
I think, like, our brand values in general are manifested in the news stories that we cover. And so we cover certain stories a little bit closer than other stories. So I don't think for us, like, we haven't really had to worry about overstepping any of those lines, because, like, if we're covering a story, we're already sort of believing in its importance, in its social significance. A lot of times we'll give, they're not warnings per se as much as they are just being like, hey, like, take a deep breath. This story is a lot to dive into, just to give a background to people so that they're prepared. And then the other thing we do is, I think we hold those social media companies responsible for the stuff they say, because we cover Instagram, we cover Facebook really closely. And what among the things that we do is say, hey, you said you're going to do these things about mental health. Where are they? Why aren't you doing them?
Right.
So those are the things that I really value about what we do.
How do you, though, personally deal with some of the stuff that Catherine's talking about? Because I mean, we've talked about this in previous episodes of this podcast, that you have a very earnest posture. So it's pretty rare. I don't think I've ever seen you get into, like, a knockdown, drag out fight on Twitter. But
sure don't.
How do you, what are your, so tell, what's the secret? Maybe people can learn from your posture.
Seekers don't get in a fight. I mean, like, it's not, I wish that there was, like, a more complicated way to explain it. But I think, like, a lot of times you see an issue that is going to be, that you know is going to be framed unjustly, let's say.
Or, like, polarized, right? We know people are polarized.
Oh, that's fine. Polarization is, I mean, like, it's not fine, but polarization is a norm, right?
Yeah.
But the idea of engaging with it, you have a choice. You have a choice whether to sort of inflame it further or not. Mm. More often than not, I don't take that choice. And I think I work in an industry where a lot of people are super happy to swing the bat every time.
Yeah, it's, let's, like, talk about that.
Maybe don't swing at that ball. Okay, like,
I want to talk about the swinging the bat, because from a business standpoint, especially for newsrooms, journalists trying to build their brand, a lot of it is like, let's go, let's fight. What does that do for the collective mental health of the social media space? And is it something that we should be caring about collectively as an industry, or is that just, it comes with the territory?
I think it's about who's behind, you know, not thinking of it as just a generic thing that happens, but that it's real people having real arguments about things. So if a specific journalist is feisty and is the kind of person who's going to pick a fight, well, then I'm hopeful that they do it because they know they can handle it and that's what they want. I think where you get...
Wait, can you just say that again? Because I don't know if journalists always think about that. Like, you know, a lot of the... I don't know if you've... I mean, you're in the same business as I am. I watch. It's interesting. You can see a lot about... And I don't know if journalists realize this, but if you spend enough time on Twitter, you can see who they are, how they feel, how they are repetitive in their positions, like, what, you know, where they're at. And sometimes I worry too for people when I watch the way that they respond on Twitter.
Well, here's an interesting point. I mean, I think these days it's expected that a journalist would sort of carry on their persona online. Yeah. And so if you work for a major news outlet and you're not visible on social platforms, then you're kind of not doing your job as fulsome a manner as someone who is. You know,
it's,
if you,
a lot of pressure,
you
though.
Follow someone, you know, in my industry, or in you know, someone like Andre Picard, for instance, is, you know, he's basically like an aggregator of all things that are important in the health world.
So true, yeah.
And so somebody like him, you know, he the service that he provides his readers through being a great Twitter voice is far extends, you know, his value as a journalist at the Globe and Mail. Right. And so there's a reason people follow him, because it builds a following for his columns on the Globe and vice versa, you know?
Yeah, right. Another good example is like Daniel Dale, which ultimately catapulted him into the US market and into CNN. Mm. I don't mean you guys don't get paid extra though for doing that kind of like really heavy lifting, you know, in the day to day to train. Don't you find it
certainly don't get paid extra for it. If my boss is listening, but it's not like I don't get anything out of it either.
Oh, interesting. Well, so break that down.
I think to me, like engaging in conversations that are happening, putting I work for a company that allows me to put my opinion out there. And like when we get to have conversations, like informative conversations about it. And what that does is also like, it raises the company's profile for sure. But also like, I think we get something out of it because we're already like using the company's platform, and that way we become more visible. And so, to me, it's like not just free labor. I think it's a little more complicated than that, but to a certain extent, you have to be mindful of how much of yourself you invest in that, because you know your head has to still actually be at your job, which is not social media.
Yeah, it's interesting from a communication standpoint. We've moved to this like short term behavior in favor sometimes to the exclusion of long term. Like Elamine's trying to write a book right now, right? Like how much of your brain is like leaning towards Twitter than it's leaning towards this long term planning and strategy and
right. Writing a book is actually the ultimate exercise in being like, is this a thought to like throw out for social media, or is it something I want to write, you know, three paragraphs about? Because what I actually ended up finding is like a lot of very good journalists end up giving away very good pitches.
Yes. It happens on our side too. Ideas on the PR side, they just like, yeah, for like sure.
A tweet here or there. And it's like, it's funny and it's pithy, but like, God, write two pages about it, because it just like we as an audience deserve more than it being just thrown out as a tweet. Mm. And so like writing a book has been like the ultimate exercise, and you're like, no, like this doesn't belong just out there in the world. it kind of deserves a bit more nuance, which has been an interesting exercise in just like self-restraint.
Yeah, Catherine, there's a lot of really bad PR, marketing, business, social generally, like very vanilla. And I often wonder what's the point if it's not really saying anything conversation-wise. What's your impression of our side of the house compared to the journalistic way of being on social?
At this point, it's not really optional. You know, it says something more about your brand if you're not on social. Mm. If you're not on social, why not? You know, can you really not make that happen? So I think it's considered a little bit of a bare minimum. Like you're just even coming to the party. And then of course there's those who do it really well and those who don't. So I don't think it's a given that just because, you know, you're on social, it's going to add value to your brand or add value to your company.
Right.
You got to figure out what you're trying to do with it.
Right. You got to have a plan. Got to have a sense of purpose about it, I guess, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I mean, I think it really depends on what, on Canadian Mental Health Association, if we're trying to promote something like our conference or a specific program or something, you know, there's very little engagement on that compared with something that's more resonant on a personal level,
right?
That's inspiring or curious or what have you. So, I mean, coming back to sort of looking at how we want people to understand mental health, it's not just about disease or wellness or illness or wellness. It's about, you know, what is good mental health, and that, you know, if you look at the mental health, the First Nations wellness continuum, they say good mental health requires a hope, purpose, belonging, and meaning.
Mm.
So if
that's actually perfect for comms and social too, though, right?
Well, that's the thing. What are you contributing to? What is your brand contributing to in terms of like helping that person? You know, is it about the sense of belonging that you know you found your peeps and you feel like a kinship on social? That's valid.
Yeah.
Are you inspiring people? Are you helping them? I mean, not that you can find everything. It's not just on social.
Right.
But if you think about mental health as not just about how do we avoid hurting someone, but how do you sort of cultivate something that's of value and enrich people's lives? Mm. And that's a little bit of a more positive and progressive understanding of what mental health really is.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
I think there's something to be said about the fact that, you know, social media has really been around for 15 years.
Is that it?
Yeah, like Facebook. I mean, Facebook particularly. So like social media 2.0 has been around for about 15 years or so.
Yeah.
And in that period of time, we've reshaped so much of how we communicate with one another.
Mm.
But we are a little bit akin to a toddler playing with a small lighter. Like we haven't figured out this this super powerful tool for communication.
Yes.
That we're like, how do we use it for the worst possible things?
Mm.
And that tells me it's still in its infancy. That doesn't mean that it's always going to be awful or it's going to become amazing one day. It's just that we're, at a certain point we'll get to temper ourselves. But I happen to be of that generation that was like kind of like flung into it, like you guys figure it out. and I think, you know, in 10 years time, I think this will be like, we will think of this past decade as, what were you people doing? You were using it in a totally illogical way.
Yeah.
That's the hope.
Or maybe even in sometimes in a destructive way, right? But I feel like if we keep talking about what's happening in the space, then maybe we'll all be a little bit better off for it. Before I let you go, just curious, can you give our audience a few tips on how to not just show up on social, but show up in a mentally healthy way, not just for yourself, but for audiences that we're sending content to?
I mean, particularly from the news perspective, I would say don't let the news happen to you.
Yeah.
It's the same way, don't let social media happen to you. Like so I took a week off using my phone for social media just a little bit earlier in the summer. So still allowed to go on all the platforms, just not on my phone. We'll still do it on desktop. What that did was just made me much more intentional about the participation process, right? So no push notifications being like, hey, a thing happened, I must respond to this. You don't have to live that way. And since then, I've taken off most of the notifications off my phone.
Yeah, it helps a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah.
There's a lot of repetition, I noticed, when I was off for a full month and I'd read the news in the morning, I'm like, oh, I got this.
Yeah.
It's nothing. I'm not missing anything, really.
I've
come back,
you're
obviously.
You're never missing anything.
No, like,
I
want to know all the things,
and
though.
And it will be okay. There was a period of time, this was not crazy to say, there was a period of time where the news happened and people didn't know about it for a day.
Wow,
or
amazing.
Or sometimes that evening. Ugh. And they were not less informed. They actually might have been more informed.
Right.
And so we just need to take ourselves out of the stream a bit.
Wow. Good. Catherine.
Well, I have the benefit of working at the Canadian Mental Health Association of having a research team, you know, who's looking at best practices and policy
and research work.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I talked to them when I was coming here about some best practices using social media.
Awesome.
So I've got a list for you guys. And I mean,
Elamine loves lists. Are you writing this down?
The thing that's really interesting is the best practices are really the unremarkable ones. You know, it's not like there's some magic silver bullet as to sort of how to be authentic and healthy online, but they're fairly, it makes sense. You know, you think before you post.
Yes, think before, like all of those country music tweets, Elamine.
I think a lot of my country
do you really
tweets before I tweet them. Yeah, for sure. Those are the most well thought out. Okay, let's get
let's better do the list.
Do the list. Set time limits for engagement.
Did they give a number of like how much is too much?
No.
Oh.
No, it's just, I think there's a difference between, hey, I'm going to go online and check the news for the next 10 minutes or, you know, I'm about to go to bed and whoops, it's 40 minutes later. You know, I think it's about being conscious of setting time limits for just intentionally about how long you're going to spend on there so that it can be more intentional. It's not just a free for all where you go down a rabbit hole. Don't respond when you're emotionally charged up.
Ooh.
That's a good one.
Yeah, but sometimes the best tweets, though, are this is the problem with Twitter.
What do you mean, best tweets?
That crackle, you know, the reason why a conversation is like exciting for me is that back and forth and back and forth. And so when you see it on Twitter, especially when I watch two journalists interact with each other, to me it's like watching
like voyeurism.
And like
right?
It's like an action movie because I'm like, ooh, what's gonna happen next? And the authenticity of it's so fantastic. But then I have seen people, you know, say things that they shouldn't, and then
maybe social media shouldn't be like an action movie.
Oh.
That's not to disappoint.
You're probably
especially,
right.
Especially when you get into the U.S. politics, you know.
Yes.
I listened to another podcast recently where someone was saying, you know, it's it's these days on social, it's like it's less about engaging, more about enraging.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
And so that's true. If you can make people mad, or so they either love you or they hate you, you know, that's where you're going to get the most response, right? Because people are like, yes.
Catherine,
or,
my whole goal.
Hell yes or
my,
hell no.
Catherine, my whole goal on Twitter is to be very boring and only and only please the two of you. So that's my goal. Good. All right. So we'll do that.
So block and report negative accounts.
Oh, yes. So that's easy.
You know, that's a fairly easy one.
Do you, you don't block? You I must just, have people come at you.
I just mute.
Oh, you so don't that way block
they'll
them.
They'll never know whether I saw their tweet or
yeah,
not.
Yeah, that's fair.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just like
oh,
a,
that's
it's,
so interesting.
Because I don't need.
You don't need a fight.
If someone, if you block, I've seen it happen where like if you block a person, then they create a different account just be like, I'm back and I'm more angry
oh,
that you blocked me.
That's interesting.
So no one needs that. I just mute accounts that I'm like, all right, I think we're done here.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
You know, avoid harassers and don't harass.
Yeah. Roger that.
Yep.
And remember that all images are highly constructed, right? So it's just you have to force yourself to remember. It's like the whole, there's a line that I really love. Like you're comparing your insides with someone else's outsides. Mm. You know, that is just.
Wow. That's that, profound, actually.
It is. And so just if you remember that this is an image, a version of something, you know, as Elamine was saying, it's a performance to a certain degree. So, you know. That is your stage version of yourself, not the one who's you know in the bathroom reading paper or whatever.
No, I'll fully admit. I bought a bike. I posted a picture of the bike. I did not post a post about falling off my bike within 20 minutes of buying it. So you know there it is, the truth. But I guess it's not. But it's okay that. How do you, just one last question about that? Like people will post the most pretty PR'd version of their lives. Do you think that there's negative elements to that, or should we be all working harder to actually post the truth?
I think I think that it is negative in general that people only see things that make them feel that they're missing out or that they're jealous or that they, because you see such a, because of the way that it's constructed, it's this constant feed. It seems like everybody else is, you know, in Bali and you're the one stuck at your desk.
Wait, right.
So, I mean, it's just, you just have to be conscious of that, that, you know, people are not, you know, posting the boring stuff. And I think that would be amazing if there was a way to get people to actually
do it for
that.
Like a week and just post like lame life stuff. I mean, let's do that. Maybe
my life is really cool, so I totally understand.
It would be really
fine.
Hard. For
okay,
him to
just
find
mine.
Those
okay.
moments, but you know, he could try.
Yeah, oh my
I
goodness,
can, I can give it a shot.
All right,
and
good.
Then the last thing is just really about your privacy settings, right? Just make sure that you're aware of what you're putting out there on purpose or not on purpose.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, I mean, if you think about it, social media is called that for a reason. I think about it as, you know, as a social. Realm. As I was saying, it's like going to a big cocktail party with hundreds of people. You know, you can go there and you could wander around that room and you could not connect with anyone, or you could make an effort and reach out and have a meaningful conversation or stick your neck out a little bit, and you could end up making a best friend. I mean, it's really about who you are, what you put out there, and how you try to connect with people and make an authentic connection. It could be via social. But just because you're at a cocktail party with 300 people doesn't mean you feel connected to them. You just still have to make an effort.
That's some really, really great advice. Well, I just want to thank both of you for coming out and connecting with me in real time, in person, on this important issue. I appreciate it. Talk again soon.
Pleasure. Thanks for having us.
Love being here. Thanks.
Thanks for listening. If you'd like to continue the conversation, you can find us on Twitter. Catherine is at Catherine Jansen, Elamine is at Elamine88, and I'm at Sophie Netto.